Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. If you're tuning into this podcast right now, you know that Democracy Now! Is news you can trust. Democracy Now! Is independent, which means we're funded by you, not the oil, gas, and coal companies when we cover climate change, or the weapons manufacturers when we cover war and peace, not the insurance industry when we cover health care. No, we're brought to you by viewers, listeners, readers like you, committed to independent information. Right now, a generous supporter will double your donation to Democracy Now! That means if you donate $15, we get $30. Take advantage of this generous offer and go to democracynow.org to make your donation today. Thank you so much. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Why you all want to control our bodies, I will never, ever know. And I know that many of you have daughters.
Lawmakers passed the most restrictive abortion ban in the country in a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade. Doctors who perform abortion could face life in prison. There's no exception for rape or incest. This means a child raped by her father could be forced to bear his child. We'll get the latest. Then we look at the standoff at the Venezuelan embassy in Washington as activists opposed to regime change refuse to leave the embassy.
We're not going to leave voluntarily. We came here to protect the embassy. We've been here for 34 days. We will stay longer if necessary. We hope that this still results in an agreement between Venezuela and the United States to protect this embassy from the fake government, the fake coup non-government that U.S. is pushing forward. So we're here. We're still resisting.
And we get the latest on Sudan, where mass protests continue calling for civilian rule following last month's military coup.
The old regime has not fallen yet. Therefore, we are staying. You have seen with your own eyes the oppression that happened. We have escalated because we rejected the decisions by the Transitional Military Council.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Alabama's legislature has just passed the most restrictive abortion ban in the country. The law effectively bans all abortions. Doctors could face life in prison for performing the procedure. The law does not make exceptions for rape or incest. The only exception lawmakers voted for is cases in which the pregnant person's health is at serious risk. The bill, which was already approved in the House last month, now heads to the desk of the Republican anti-choice governor, Kay Ivey. She has not yet indicated if she'll support such drastic legislation. The bill is expected to face multiple legal challenges if signed. Supporters of the bill say they'll hope it ends up in the Supreme Court and lead to the eventual reversal of Roe v. Wade. Democratic State Senator Vivian Figueres, one of four women serving in the chamber, introduced an amendment that would criminalize vasectomies, arguing there are no laws regulating men's bodies. It was defeated. We'll have more on the ongoing attack on reproductive rights around the country later in the broadcast. The State Department's ordered all non-emergency personnel to evacuate the U.S. Embassy and consulate in Iraq. The orders in response to what the White House says is a threat linked to Iran, though no further details were given. Iraqi officials expressed skepticism about any purported threats, as did a senior British official who's the deputy commander of the American-led coalition fighting the Islamic State. Tensions between the U.S. and Iran have continued to mount over recent days, despite both parties saying they're not seeking war. The U.S. recently deployed a carrier strike group and a bomber task force to the region, claiming a credible threat by Iranian regime forces, though not showing any evidence. On Tuesday, rebel Houthi forces from Yemen claimed responsibility for launching an armed drone attack against a Saudi oil facility near the Saudi capital, Riyadh. Some experts have said this was not the first such attack by Houthi Houthis against Saudi targets, and no evidence has been revealed to tie Iran, which backs the Houthis, to the attack. The attack came 2 days after 4 oil tankers, including 2 Saudi tankers, were damaged off the coast of the United Arab Emirates in what Saudi Arabia described as a sabotage attack. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in Sochi, Russia, Tuesday, where the two discussed issues including Iran, Venezuela, and the 2020 elections. Russia criticized the U.S. decision to withdraw last year from the landmark 2015 Iran nuclear deal, as tensions between the U.S. and Iran are at their highest since Trump took office. On Venezuela, Lavrov again warned the U.S. against any attempts to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro.
We remember back in 2003, in May, I suppose, then President of the United States, George Bush Jr., from board an aircraft carrier, declared that democracy was established in Iraq. We remember back in 2011, it was declared that Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi had been brought down and that democracy was established in Libya. I believe I do not need to dwell at length upon today's state of democracy in Iraq, Libya, and a number of other places where such attempts of overthrowing the regimes were made and nothing good came out of it.
Pompeo also warned Russia not to interfere in the 2020 U.S. elections, while Lavrov denied Russia was involved in any 2016 election meddling. Pompeo also met with Russian President Vladimir Putin, who hailed the Mueller report, saying it, quote, confirmed the absence of any collusion between the U.S. administration and Russia. CNN's obtained photos showing the dire conditions migrants are being held in at the McAllen, Texas Border Patrol. The photos show adults and children sleeping outside on the ground, in some cases on rocks, as well as packed into tents and covered with Mylar blankets. The photos were supplied by a source who said they were disturbed when they witnessed the conditions at the station over the weekend. Responding to the report, an official from the Department of Homeland Security said, quote, the border security and humanitarian crisis continues to worsen. Current facilities and funding are inadequate for migrant flows, unquote. In related news, CNN is reporting this morning that the Transportation Security Administration's planning on sending hundreds of officials to the southern border to address increased migrant arrivals. Pennsylvania has become the latest state to go after Purdue Pharma for its role in producing and marketing the highly addictive opioid OxyContin. Purdue allegedly targeted senior citizens and the military when pushing the drug. The lawsuits state, quote, even when Purdue knew people were addicted and dying, Purdue treated patients and their doctors as targets to sell more drugs. Tragically, each part of Purdue's campaign of deception earned the company more money and caused more addiction and death. According to reports Tuesday, Donald Trump Jr. has agreed to answer questions from the Senate Intelligence Committee after the Republican-led panel subpoenaed him last week to return to Capitol Hill to testify about his role in matters related to the Russia investigation. He'll reportedly sit for 2 to 4 hours of questioning on a number of agreed-upon topics next month. San Francisco has become the first major U.S. city to ban the use of facial recognition technology by police and other city agencies. Under the new rule, city agencies would need to obtain permission from the city's Board of Supervisors before implementing any new surveillance technologies. The biometric technology can still be employed at San Francisco's airport since it's controlled by the federal government. Matt Cagle, an attorney with the ACLU of Northern California, hailed the decision and said such technology, quote, provides government with unprecedented power to track people going about their daily lives. That's incompatible with a healthy democracy, he said. Experts have also warned about racial and other kinds of bias. CBS News is reporting members of the American Airlines Pilots Union confronted Boeing in late 2018 about features on the 737 MAX aircraft that have been implicated in 2 fatal crashes. Audio has been released of an exchange between pilots and Boeing executives recorded in November 2018, less than a month after the Indonesia Lion Air Flight 610, which killed all 189 people on board, and just 4 months before Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302, which killed 157 people.
We flat out deserve to know what is on our airplanes.
I don't disagree.
Pilots expressed anger that a faulty sensor system on the 737 MAX was not communicated to them until after the first deadly accident and pushed Boeing to work urgently on fixing the issue. The MAX 737 is still grounded, and multiple lawsuits and investigations into the crashes are underway. In New York City, a group of climate activists are on the second day of a three-day hunger strike in front of Governor Andrew Cuomo's office ahead of this Thursday's permitting deadline for the proposed Williams Pipeline project, which would carry frack gas from Pennsylvania's shale fields under New York Harbor. Activists are urging Cuomo, who's called for New York's own Green New Deal, to halt the project, which they say will harm New York waters, public health, safety, democracy, and the climate. A police officer in Baytown, Texas, has been put on paid leave after a cell phone video of him fatally shooting a black woman went viral Tuesday. In the video, 44-year-old Pamela Turner can be seen in a verbal altercation with the unidentified officer in an apartment complex parking lot. She's heard telling him, quote, "You're actually harassing me," before he tases her and she falls to the ground. Moments later, she yells out, "I'm pregnant," which is followed by five gunshots, killing Turner. Police say the officer opened fire after Turner grabbed the taser and used it against him. Police also say postmortem examination showed Pamela Turner was not pregnant. Family members have since told local media she suffered from mental health issues. The ACLU is calling for an independent investigation. The National Bailout Collective announced Tuesday that the third annual Black Mamas Bailout Day freed over 100 black mothers in over 35 cities and counting for Mother's Day. They also raised over $1 million. The nationwide campaign aims to call attention to the injustice of cash bail while freeing as many black women from jail as possible. To see our recent interview about the Black Mamas Bailout Day campaign, go to democracynow.org. And in New York City, protesters rallied outside the Marriott Marquis Hotel in Times Square Tuesday as the Brazilian American Chamber of Commerce held a black tie gala dinner honoring Brazil's far-right president Jair Bolsonaro and U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Bolsonaro was initially scheduled to attend the gala but canceled those plans earlier this month after he came under heavy protest over his long history of homophobic, racist and misogynistic comments. The awards gala was moved from the American Museum of Natural History after a campaign by environmentalists pointed to Bolsonaro's efforts to open the Amazon to deforestation and mining while violating the rights of indigenous people. This is Natalia de Campos of the Defend Democracy in Brazil Committee.
We're here in front of the Marriott Marquis Hotel in Times Square, where an event tonight will be held for the Brazilian American Chamber of Commerce Person of the Year Award, honoring Jair Bolsonaro, President of Brazil, and Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State of the U.S. The Brazilian American Chamber of Commerce has clear deals with corporations that are buying off the assets of Brazil and also supporting intervention in Latin America, such as against Venezuela or in Brazil itself, setting up bases, military bases of the U.S. there now. So Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is very much in favor of these policies.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Alabama lawmakers voted to effectively ban abortion Tuesday, passing the most restrictive anti-choice law in the country in a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade. The bill, approved by the Senate Tuesday in the Alabama House last month, bans abortions at all phases. Doctors could face up to 99 years in prison for performing abortions. The bill includes no exceptions for survivors of rape and incest. Its only exception is grave risk to the mother's life. The legislation is now heading to the desk of anti-choice Republican Governor Kay Ivey, and many expect she'll sign it. Opponents say they'll challenge the bill in court should it become law. But that's precisely the point. Architects behind the legislation want to use it to challenge Roe v. Wade, which recognizes the constitutional right to an abortion.
Just one day before Alabama passed the legislation, Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer issued what many considered a dire warning from the bench, implying that Roe v. Wade is in danger. He wrote the comments in a dissent for an unrelated case in which the court voted to overturn a 40-year-old precedent. Breyer wrote, quote, "Today's decision can only cause one to wonder which cases the court will overrule next."
This attack on reproductive rights is playing out in state legislatures across the country. Also on Tuesday, the Republican-led Michigan Senate passed bills to ban the most common method of second trimester abortion and criminalize abortion providers. Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer is expected to veto the legislation. Last week, Georgia Republican Governor Brian Kemp signed one of the most restrictive abortion laws in the U.S., banning abortion when a fetal heartbeat can be detected, which often occurs at around 6 weeks into pregnancy, before many women even realize they're pregnant. The new law is set to take effect on January 1, 2020.
Ohio Governor Mike DeWine also signed into law a six-week abortion ban last month. The legislation does not include exceptions for cases of rape or incest. Well, for more, we're joined by Monica Simpson, executive director of Sister Song, a woman of color reproductive justice collective. She's in Denver today, but she's based in Atlanta, Georgia. And we're joined by Jessica Mason Piclo, legal analyst and vice president of law in the courts at Rewire. She's the co-author of Crow After Roe, How Separate But Equal Has Become the New Standard in Women's Health, and How We Can Change That. Her forthcoming book, written with Robin Marty, is The End of Roe v. Wade, Inside the Rights Plan to Destroy Legal Abortion. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Jessica, let's begin with you. Explain what just happened in Alabama.
What just happened in Alabama is that lawmakers launched a full frontal attack on legal abortion in the state and across the country with a law designed specifically to challenge Roe versus Wade in the long term and in the short term. So chaos in the state of Alabama for folks who need access to abortion.
And could you talk about Justice Breyer's warning, how that specifically might relate to Roe v. Wade in terms of his dissent in an unrelated case?
Absolutely. On Monday, the Supreme Court issued a 5-4 decision in effectively a tax case. And Justice Thomas took the lead in that decision and upended 40 years of precedent. And that, on the face, has absolutely nothing to do with abortion rights. But as Justice Breyer noted, the path that the court took in getting to the outcome has absolutely everything to do with abortion rights. When we look at the conservative wing of the court looking to enact an agenda that lawmakers at the states have volleyed up for them in these anti-choice bills. And so what Justice Breyer did was go through the concept of stare decisis and precedent that the majority in this decision had overturned and suggested how that they could do the same thing when it came to other areas like abortion rights and contraception, for example.
This is Alabama State Senator Linda Coleman Madison speaking at the debate yesterday before Alabama voted an almost total abortion ban.
This bill to me appears to be about control. When the dust settles at the end, and if this bill passes on a roll call vote, you will be telling your wives, your daughters, your granddaughters, and those who support this bill that you don't value the worth of women, regardless of how educated, how sound of mind, how competent, how knowledgeable, no matter how many degrees they have, or how many of these same women you have paid your hard-earned money to educate, that their voice does not matter. We don't trust you to make a decision that is the most personal and precious decision about your own body. And that includes your offsprings, your grandchildren.
So that's Alabama State Senator Linda Coleman Madison speaking just before the Alabama State Senate followed the example of the Alabama House of Representatives and voted for the almost complete abortion ban. Jessica Mason Peeklow, go further in explaining exactly what it means, you know, putting doctors in prison for life if they perform the procedure, 11-year-old kid who's raped by her father, forced to bear her father's child. Talk about why the no exceptions, what the legislature, what Alabama is hoping to do at the Supreme Court.
Well, they're hoping quite clearly to upend legal abortion in any way that they can with this bill. And so by not having any exceptions, for example, they are taking a direct attack on the line of precedent in Roe that says states can enact certain measures before viability, for example, but there need to be exceptions maintained for the health of the pregnant person and their life, for example. What is really happening here, though, that I think is most important to dive into is that lawmakers have said very specifically that they know this bill is unconstitutional, that their design by passing this is to force a court challenge. And Republicans have spent the last 2 years packing the federal courts with ideologues who have promised, if given the opportunity, to upend Roe versus Wade. So this is a political campaign that is being waged in the courts right now because conservatives and Republicans really feel that they have the advantage here. And we're seeing in places where pregnant people are already criminalized for certain pregnancy outcomes. The impact of upending legal abortion is starting and has started in places. But what this does is put that on hyperspeed and says very clearly that lawmakers don't care what the law is. They don't care that this is an unconstitutional ban. That's the point of it. And so the question is whether or not the federal courts are going to do their job and not be ideological in this and apply the law. And should they do that, then this ban is dead in the water.
Now, Monica Simpson, you're usually based in Georgia. Could you talk about what's been happening in your state and this whole issue of this political offensive by the anti-choice forces? Clearly, there is an effect, not only an attempt not only to overturn Roe v. Wade, but also to mobilize the anti-choice movement as we head into the presidential elections next year.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me this morning. I will say that today, those of us who have been doing this work in Georgia and who have just faced the same battles that our folks in Alabama are facing as of yesterday, we're standing in solidarity with Alabama and all the other states and folks who are dealing with these issues all across the country. And what we see and what we've been able to really come to grips with in this country is that this has been a steady and a very stealth approach that our opposition has taken against us at the state level. And what we are seeing here that in Georgia, what we're seeing now in Alabama, is that they are making a very clear message that they do not care about us. They do not care about our ability to make our own decisions, about our bodies, about our families, about how we want to create family. And it is what we're trying to do now, what we're working to do collectively, is to build our voices, to build our people power against that. But we have been seeing since 2011 over 400 different measures come through state houses that have been medically unnecessary, and they have been using their political agenda to really move this very clear message and to get us to the point that we are now. And so, yes, we are at a point where we have to be ready to mount up all of our defenses against this, and that's exactly what we're doing in Georgia, and that's exactly what we're going to be doing across this country.
This is Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp speaking last week after signing into law Georgia's 6-week abortion ban.
The LIFE Act is very simple, but also very powerful. A declaration that all life has value, that all life matters, and that all life is worthy of protection. I understand, like the others have said, that some oppose this legislation. I realize that some may challenge it in the court of law. But our job is to do what is right, not what is easy. We are called to be strong and courageous. And we will not back down. We will always continue to fight for life.
That's Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp speaking last week after signing into law the 6-week abortion ban. Stacey Abrams, the Democratic politician who narrowly lost Brian Kemp, who was the Secretary of State, the Republican governor's race, tweeted after the bill was signed into law, "Bad policies like the forced pregnancy bill are a direct result of voter suppression. If leaders can silence Georgians' voices at the ballot box, they can ignore Georgians' voices when in office. We will fight back in court and at the voting booth," she said. If Monica Simpson, if you can talk about what happened on the ground in Georgia and particularly how these abortion bans affect women of color.
Absolutely. On the ground, we have been working together collectively. We, across different organizations, across our sectors of reproductive health rights and justice, formed the Georgia Coalition for Reproductive Health Rights and Justice to be in lockstep, to be in connection with each other as we were fighting on the ground, moving at the grassroots level all the way up to our state house to make sure that we were educating our communities, amplifying the needs and the voices of the most marginalized in our community to really fight back against this. And what's interesting whenever I hear Kemp say that we need to make courageous decisions and that, you know, we should make these, not make the easy decisions. There are so many things that Georgia could be actually fighting for that would actually impact the lives of those living in the margins. We are a state where we are at the very bottom when it comes to maternal mortality. And we see that Black women are dying at a rate 4 times higher than white women in childbirth. We are a state that has yet to expand Medicaid. We are a state where we still need to be making sure that we are creating economic opportunities for people to be able to survive and thrive. But instead of really focusing on those issues, which have been what our folks on the ground have asked for of our elected officials, of the governor of this, of our state, instead we're moving forward measures that actually decrease access and put people at risk. And when we have things like a 6-week abortion ban in place, and if that's something that moves forward, which we're going to fight every single day to make sure that it doesn't, things like that, when you put those different measures in place, we know who gets impacted the most. It's folks of color, marginalized communities, young people. Those folks, their lives are the ones that are the most at risk. So instead of listening to the folks of Georgia and listening to the needs of the people of Georgia, we have folks in office who are really focused on moving their political agenda and using our bodies and our wombs as collateral. And we say no more to that. And so we are working together collectively to build that people power, to make sure that we are fighting this at every level that we most possibly can. But on the ground, we have been working diligently to build that collective power, to make sure that we have what is necessary for us to fight this at every level.
Jessica Mason Pinkler, I'm wondering if you could talk about Ohio, a key, obviously, battleground state in the upcoming presidential race, and the abortion law there.
Right. Well, we have seen Ohio try to enact as many anti-abortion measures as they can, including one of these 6-week bans, in addition to a ban on later abortion, which is tied up in the courts. And you mentioned Ohio is a battleground state, and I think it's really important to bring this back into this idea of disenfranchisement and who is passing this and why. You know, we have seen success from the last 40 years of having broader reproductive or access to reproductive health services and the ability to plan families and to try and parent as we choose. And so it is no surprise that in those states where some of those advances have taken place in rapid form, we're seeing such a pushback. And so I so appreciate Stacey Abrams making that connection in terms of disenfranchisement. I don't think we can say that enough. These are bills that are designed to keep people out of civic life and out of the political process. And so Ohio is an excellent example of this, where there is good support for abortion rights and access on the ground and in its citizenry, but the politicians are using the power that they have right now to try and stymie that. And it is important because Ohio sits in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and that is also a federal circuit court of appeals that has been newly made more conservative thanks to Trump appointees. And so when I talk about this as a political campaign that's being waged in the courts, those are the dots that I hope people are starting to connect, because they are all connected.
Do you actually see Roe being overturned?
That's an excellent question. I do. I think that, you know, there are two paths that conservatives can take. They can continue on an incrementalist approach, which we are seeing them attempting in the states through various types of procedure bans, through trap restrictions that we've talked about previously on this show. Or they can go for the brass ring and go for Roe altogether. And we're seeing them take that path now. You know, the question will be ultimately, what stomach does Chief Justice John Roberts have for overturning precedent here? We've seen early indications that he is uncomfortable by some of the political nature of what is happening. However, when it comes to a substantive vote in defense of abortion rights, Chief Justice John Roberts has yet to cast one in favor of abortion rights on the merits. And so I think that it is well within our concern to think that Roe versus Wade could be overturned in the next several years.
We're going to end with a video that went viral just a few months ago. It's Georgia Democratic State Senator Jen Jordan speaking against the abortion ban on the Georgia State Senate floor in March.
The deepest, darkest times of my life have occurred in the presence of and with my physician. You see, I've been pregnant 10 times. I have seen what many of you in here have called a heartbeat 10 times. But I have only given birth twice. I have lost 7 pregnancies in varying points of time before 20 weeks and 1 after 5 months. Her name was Juliet. I have laid on the cold examination table while a doctor desperately looked for a heartbeat. I have been escorted out the back door of my physician's office so as not to upset the other pregnant women in the waiting area, my grief on full display and uncontainable. I have been on my knees time after time in prayer to my God about my losses. I have loved each and every single one of those potential lives, and my husband and I have grieved each passing. But no matter my faith, my beliefs, my losses, I have never, ever strayed from the basic principle that each woman must be able to make her decisions in consultation with her God and her family. It is not for the government or the men of this chamber to insert itself in the most personal, private, and wrenching decisions that make every single day. And that's not some smiley, happy statement that's been focused grouped. That is the reality of our lives. And let me be clear. If you shirk the most basic duties you have to protect the fundamental rights of women today, then no doubt the women of this state will reclaim their rights after they have claimed your seats.
That's Georgia State Senator Jen Jordan speaking in March. And that does it for this segment. We want to thank Monica Simpson, executive director of Sister Song, a woman of color reproductive justice collective based in Atlanta, Georgia, and Jessica Mason Piccolo, legal analyst and vice president of law in the courts at Rewire. She's co-author of Crow After Roe, How Separate But Equal Has Become the New Standard in Women's Health and How We Can Change That, her forthcoming book, The End of Roe v. Wade, Inside the Rights Plan to Destroy Legal Abortion. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. When we come back, what's happening at the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C.? Stay with us.
Thanks for all your help.
Rational actor by Knotts. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
In Washington, D.C., four activists remain in the Venezuelan embassy after police raided the building Monday night. Activists with Code Pink, Answer Coalition, and Popular Resistance have been inside the building since late April at the invitation of Venezuela's government. In order to prevent it from being taken over by Venezuela's U.S.-backed opposition led by Juan Guaido.
Last week, authorities cut off water and electricity to the Venezuelan embassy. As they were on the verge of being raided Monday, activists released a video statement vowing to continue the fight.
We're not going to leave voluntarily. We came here to protect the embassy. We've been here for 34 days. We will stay longer if necessary. We hope that this still results in an agreement between Venezuela and the United States to protect this embassy from the fake government, the fake coup non-government that U.S. is pushing forward. So we're here. We're still resisting.
To find out more, we're going to Washington, D.C. to speak with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, one of the activists living inside the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C., demanding the embassy not be turned over to the Venezuelan opposition leaders. Medea, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain the standoff right now.
It's a remarkable situation, Amy. 2 days ago, the police came in with a fake eviction notice. It was written on a piece of paper that had no letterhead, no seal, no signature. We didn't know who it came from. And the police read this out as if it were an official eviction notice. Our lawyer, who has been fantastic, Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, went to speak to the people remaining in the embassy, and they discussed the situation and said they were not going to leave. The only way they would leave is once there is an arrangement between Venezuela and the United States as to what will happen to both embassies, an arrangement that respects the Vienna Convention. And so the police cut the locks on the doors, and they read the eviction notice. And our brave heroes inside the embassy said that they would not leave. We all thought that this was the end, that they were going to be carried out. The Guaido supporters outside were cheering. And instead, the police turned around, closed the doors, put the lock back on, and left. And so that is the situation today. Nothing happened yesterday. We thought they would come back with some kind of court order. They did not. And the standoff remains. This is quite a remarkable chapter in history where very brave, valiant U.S. citizens, both inside the embassy at the permission of the legal Venezuela government and people outside who have been facing harassment, being arrested for trying to bring food into the embassy, have held on to that embassy now for 5 weeks and continue to do so.
Well, Medea, I want to read from the eviction notice. It read in part, quote, Ambassadors Vecchio and Gustavo Tade have requested and directed anyone who is present on this property to depart from it immediately and to not return without these ambassadors' express authorization. Any person who refuses to comply with these requests and orders to depart from this property will be trespassing in violation of federal and District of Columbia law, may be arrested and criminally prosecuted. But now there's only one problem, Medea. Any embassy is in effect, isn't it international territory? So this whole issue of even the D.C. police being involved in this is questionable, to say the least?
Absolutely, Juan. We have the law on our side, invited by the government that is in power, the government that is recognized by the United Nations. It is very clear in the Vienna Conventions in Article 45 that even if there is a rupture of relations between two states, the hosting country has to respect the integrity of the diplomatic premises. U.S. knows this very well. The State Department knows this very well. And we have been very clear that anybody who illegally enters that embassy to try to evict us is committing an illegal act and will be held accountable. There are people in the U.S. government that also recognize the grave precedent that this would establish, that it would have repercussions against U.S. embassies around the world. We want to protect not only the Venezuela embassy from takeover by an illegal group, but we want to prevent the Maduro government from taking over the U.S. embassy in Caracas. And there is a very easy answer to all of this that has been used since the 1800s, and that is called Protection Power Agreement, that we get an outside country, a third party, and that party then becomes the one in charge of the building. This has happened in the case of Iran, in Cuba, in North Korea. The U.S. has often used the countries such as Sweden and Switzerland to protect its embassies, and this could be easily done in the case of the U.S. and Venezuela right now. In fact, there are talks between the two countries to do this, and that's why it's so important that we hang on in this embassy until an agreement is reached. And once that protecting power agreement is reached, then the U.S. and Venezuela could potentially talk about other issues as well to try to end this crisis that could otherwise lead not only to a takeover of this embassy and a takeover of the U.S. embassy in Caracas, but could lead to a U.S. military intervention, a civil war in Venezuela that could rage on for decades. So we are doing this to uphold international law and to prevent a war.
And Medea, I wanted to ask you, in terms of this whole issue of the legitimate government of Venezuela inviting those protesters into the embassy to protect it. The Washington Post had a very interesting article a couple of days ago, supposedly going behind the scenes of the most recent failed coup attempt, because there have already been three this year against Maduro. But one of the things it mentions is that President Trump has become increasingly angry that he's believed he was misled at how easy it would be to get rid of Maduro. And he's now angry at his own advisors. I think it was yesterday, Mauricio Claver Caron, one of the key national security people, said in Colombia at a meeting there that he believes that Maduro is totally paranoid and can't trust anybody, and that he can count on one hand the number of people who support Maduro. That's pretty much at odds with the reality of the facts on the ground. But I'm wondering your take on these recent developments.
I think the president is understanding that he was given bad information. The really bad actor in all of this is John Bolton, who is itching for an intervention, that there has to be a walking back of the U.S. position, because the U.S. has now backed itself against a wall, recognizing somebody who doesn't have the ability to create the kind of uprising that Trump was told he did. And so part of our reasoning to be in the embassy is to help facilitate that walking back. I also want to mention that we have Reverend Jesse Jackson coming to the embassy today, this afternoon at 2:30, with a bunch of religious leaders to say that we need to get food and water into that embassy. And we will also be having a press conference at the UN with the Venezuelan government today at 4:00 to talk about the violations of their embassy and how the U.S. must respect the Vienna Conventions.
You know, talking about Trump being frustrated that he was told that they could throw out the democratically elected president of Venezuela, whatever people think of him. Do you have a sense that now with this, that now Trump is just shifting focus to Iran right now, where possibly he thinks, to the shock of many, he could be more successful? The State Department just today ordering all non-emergency personnel to evacuate the U.S. Embassy and consulate in Iraq. The order is in response to what the White House says is a threat linked to Iran, though no further details were given. Iraqi officials expressed expressing skepticism about any purported threats, as did a senior British official who's the deputy commander of the U.S.-led coalition fighting the Islamic State there. And then you have the expose in the New York Times that the Trump administration has ordered the Pentagon to draw up plans to bring 120,000 troops to the region. You just recently returned, Medea Benjamin, from Iran. Can you respond to what's happening right now?
We are very concerned about what's happening now. The U.S. has taken so many measures just in the last year to move towards a war with Iran, starting with pulling out of the nuclear deal, designating the Iran Revolutionary Guards as a terrorist organization, trying to get the Iranian oil exports down to zero, creating chaos in the Iranian economy. And of course, Iran is going to prepare itself for what looks like an attack. And this is also can be put on John Bolton, who has been calling for an attack on Iran since before he ever got into the administration. I think this is a time where we have to build up an anti-war movement again. We are seeing a repeat of what happened in Iraq with lies, misinterpretations, not only being put out by this administration, but being echoed by the mainstream media, including the New York Times. We have a mobilization at the Venezuelan embassy on Saturday in D.C. That we encourage people to come to. And from there, we're going to be going to the White House to protest this escalation of tensions with Iran and say no to a war with Iran. We have to be pushing our members of Congress to speak out forcefully against what the Trump administration is now doing and to say this is a totally manufactured crisis and the U.S. people will not stand for another war in the Middle East.
And, yeah, I want to ask you, President Trump, yesterday, after the New York Times report came out, denied that he's actually issued that order to mobilize 120,000 troops. How do you deal with the reality that so many reports that come out about what the Trump administration is planning to do, then Trump himself comes out and says, no, I didn't do that, or I didn't order that, or I'm not doing that? It's very difficult to figure out what the policies of this administration are.
Absolutely. And then in the same breath, he said, I didn't order it, but if we were going to do it, we'd send even more than 120,000 troops. It is, I think, important to understand that these policies are being organized by John Bolton. John Bolton, who is so close to the MEK in the case of Iran. John Bolton, who has said before that he wants to bomb Iran. John Bolton, that is so close to the Saudis and to Israel. And, of course, Donald Trump himself having an even closer relationship to the Saudis and to Israel. Has made the situation in Iran extremely dangerous. The only thing that's going to counter this is if we get Congress to stand up, to pass legislation that says we will not allow any unauthorized attack on either Iran or Venezuela. If we get all the presidential candidates to stand up and say no to an attack on Iran, and if we get the American people to be very loud and clear saying we are totally opposed to any attack on Iran. And further than that, we should be calling for a lifting of the crippling economic sanctions in the case of both Iran and Venezuela. We should be calling for the U.S. to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. These are positions that we should demand of our members of Congress, the administration, and all of the presidential candidates.
Medea Benjamin, bueno, thank you for being with us, co-founder of Code Pink, one of the activists who had lived inside the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C., demanding the embassy not be turned over to Venezuelan opposition leaders. She was in Iran earlier this year, the author of several books, including Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connection, her latest book, Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, what's happening in Sudan? Stay with us.
Yeah.
Arms like boulders by the war on drugs. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to Sudan, where mass protests continue to call for civilian rule following last month's military coup. On Monday, Transitional Military Council said that it has reached an agreement with protest leaders on a transitional power structure. Demonstrators have been demanding a transfer from military to civilian rule following last month's military coup that ousted longtime leader Omar al-Bashir. The announcement comes after at least six protesters and a member of the security forces were killed when security and military troops opened fire on crowds outside military headquarters in the capital Khartoum Monday. Dozens more were injured.
Also on Monday, deposed President Omar al-Bashir was charged in the killing of protesters during the popular uprising, which led to his overthrow last month. One of the deaths being investigated is that of a doctor who was shot dead while assisting injured protesters. The Central Committee of Sudan Doctors says 90 people were killed during the months-long and still ongoing protests. Demonstrators have vowed to continue to sit in and march until the government's transition to 100% civilian rule. Well, for more, we're joined by Maureen El-Neil, a Sudanese activist based here in New York City. She was just in Sudan, where she was detained. Maureen, can you give us an update on what's taking place? I mean, the most astounding image in the last weeks of ultimately the protesters forcing out the dictator, the long-reigning dictator, but then charging that a kind of military coup was taking place. Talk about the what's happened.
What has happened, the updates since the ousting of Omar al-Bashir, is that the Declaration of Freedom and Change Forces have been in negotiation with the so-called Transitional Military Council. The most recent updates is that with the press conference that happened yesterday, they have announced that they've reached an agreement on a few points. Some of them is that they'll have a transitional period of up to 3 years. First 6 months being for peace building and the stopping of the war. They've also agreed on a legislative council that will have 300 members, 67% of which they're going to be elected or appointed by the Declaration of Freedom and Change Forces. 33% are from other bodies not clearly defined yet. They have also agreed on an investigative committee on the events of the massacre of May 13th. And they've also agreed on a committee that's going to be a joint committee between the military and the field committees of the Declaration of Freedom and Change Forces. This basically means the on-the-ground protesters. This committee will be for keeping the safety and security within the sit-in. That kind of indicates that both the Transitional Military Council and the Declaration of Freedom and Change Forces, they're expecting that the sit-in will continue for some time and it's not going to be ending soon. The one thing that they have not agreed upon yet, or at least have not declared to the public, is the Sovereign Leadership Council. And that is the most important point. Who's going to be in the council? Are there going to be our military personnel represented? Who are these personnel? And what is the percentage? This council is supposed to be non-hierarchical. Every member should have their voices have equal weight. But it's going to be difficult or practically impossible for the civilian people and the military representatives in the council to have equal weight. And at the end of the day, the military personnel have an army under their command.
Well, and that's the problem of the popular uprisings that overthrow a long-term dictator, that the opposition is not organized and has its political parties and its organizations in place, but the military obviously does. So it's a lot easier for them to attempt to assume control. For instance, in Egypt and other places, we've seen the popular movements crushed as a result of the fact that the opposition was not united. So how do you see this transition period working itself out? Or do you think that the military is going to try to re-exert itself and maintain control of the country?
The protesters have been drawing a lot of parallels with Egypt, and they've been using it as a cautionary tale, reassuring each other that we should take it slow to make sure that the military does not take over and it remains a revolution of the people. Another aspect is that the military is not so united as it might seem. For example, we've seen that in the police there's a movement called Lieutenant and Under, where you've seen unionization within the police. And we've also seen people in the army who are refusing the orders of their superiors and siding with the people. There have been the famous Hamid who tried to protect the people during the events of April 6th and 7th and 8th when there were clashes between the army and the rapid support forces at the sit-in.
And who is Hamid? Who was that? What
this happened? Was Hamid. Hamid is a lower-ranking officer in the army, and he's become famous for siding with the people.
I want to turn to one of the protesters who was wounded on Monday in violence that broke out after the political transition deal was made between the mainstream opposition and military rulers. This is Raed Mubarak.
I took a bullet. He shot a bullet at me. He was 20 meters away from me at most. He saw me and he meant to shoot me. It was intentional, I mean. The bullet should have hit me. He did not even shoot at my leg or up in the air. He shot at my chest, at the left, intending to hit my heart. He meant to kill me, not to scare me or anything.
So that is a protester. So you have the military opening fire on the protesters, killing a number of them. And yet at the same time, Omar al-Bashir is in the very prison that he sentenced so many opposition to, where so many people were tortured. He now is there and just charged with murder for suppressing protests and killing protesters.
The charges that have been presented at Omar al-Bashir are not sufficient at the end of the day. If he's charged for killing of the protesters, who has he been ordering? Has he been ordering the military? Then his generals should also be charged. His generals are still at the military council. If it was through the National Intelligence and Security Services, then Salah Ghosh, the former director, should also be charged, and maybe other figures, prominent figures at National Intelligence and Security Services. If it's through the rapid support forces, being led by Himeti, then also Himeti should be charged. So these charges, the protesters realize that the military council might try to scapegoat Omar al-Bashir for other generals and other prominent figures to be able to stay in power.
What's been the posture of some of the neighboring states that might be affected in one way or another by the uprising in Sudan? I'm thinking specifically of Ethiopia and Egypt. How have they been reacting to the revolution that's been occurring in your country?
The protesters have been very wary about international intervention. Recently, we have seen that some of the Declaration of Freedom and Change forces, or some of the forces that have signed the declaration, have had meetings in the United Arab Emirates. They've seen a great backlash by the protesters, saying that if we're allowing these people to have a say in our revolution, then they will make sure that some things continue with the transitional government, such as our involvement in Yemen. And these are one of the demands of the protesters is that we bring back the people who have been fighting in Yemen, a lot of them child soldiers.
Can you talk about the role of women in leading the opposition and the protests in the streets, and how large are these protests still?
The protest, especially the sit-in, has been expanding. Initially, it was only at in front of the military headquarters. Now it's expanding to other major streets, such as Nile Street, where the protesters have been attacked on May 13th. The role of the women, you can see it in the numbers of the women at the sit-in, and you can also see it in the leadership roles that they're playing on the ground, leading some movements in the ground and other initiatives that are not directly towards the transition, but such things as the education of the street children who have taken shelter at the sit-in. You see it in the large number of female doctors who are helping on the ground, and of course, just the protesters.
And what happened to you when you were there?
I was there during December and January. We've seen similar violence to May 13th on January 17th. This is when Dr. Babakir was shot, and two other people have lost their lives that day. And hundreds of people were detained, including myself and other friends and family members. We remained detained for 6 days, and we were released. We do not know why we were detained, and we do not know why we were released. And I think that's the case with a lot of other protesters as well.
And you're planning to return. What are you hoping to do when you get back there?
Things are moving so fast. I'm not even sure how it will be when I return. I will be arriving to Sudan on Sunday. I might see a transitional government, or I do expect that I will see protesters protesting what the Declaration of Freedom and Change Forces have agreed upon. If they are allowing too many or specific people from the military to be on the Sovereign Leadership Council, I'm hoping to join those protests that will be calling for a more fair representation of civilians and for certain figures such as Abdel Fattah Burhan and Himeiti to not be on the council because there needs to be a due process of accountability.
We want to thank you so much, Maureen El-Neil, for joining us. Sudanese activists based here in New York City, recently back from Sudan, headed back there. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for paid six-month internships here in our New York studio. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Tay Maria Studio, and Libby Rainey. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira, engineers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.